Welcome. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to this PPD NQCC joint seminar titled Spectral Split and Quantum Bits. Our speaker, welcome, David, and thank you for being such a sport yesterday through all of our adventures. If you want to know about it, I will be happy to share it at lunchtime. About our speaker, David is a molecular astrophysicist with interest in planetary biosignature, molecules in extreme environments, quantum computing, and machine learning. He is an award-winning senior lecturer in the molecular physics and astrochemistry at the University of Hull, and teaches advanced quantum mechanics, astrochemistry, data science, and scientific computing. He holds a biochemistry degree from University of Lausanne, a PhD in theoretical chemistry from UCL, and a German habilitation in theoretical chemistry. And David has authored over 70 peer-reviewed publications and has 25 plus years of experience in developing high-performance computing solutions for problems in quantum chemistry, molecular physics, and astrochemistry. He is an associate editor of Frontiers in Astronomy and Space Science, mainly Astrochemistry Division. The principal UK investigator for the EU ATMOS project and a collaboration partner for the KM3 neutrino experiment. He has many other accolades in his in CV, but I will just skip them for now and let's get to the seminar. Thank you, David, and welcome the speaker.
Thank you very much. But I guess that was the final round.
Yes.
So we do. Okay. Well, thank you very much for inviting me here today. It was an eventful statement. It's okay. So I think, despite I think all the various interests that you mentioned, I also have quite a lot of interest in neutrino physics, and I think this is probably also why it feels like it's a good idea to come and talk to you guys today. So because this talk will touch on lots of astrophysics, particle physics, quantum computing, I thought I'd have a bit of a recap of everything as I go along. Any astrophysicists in the audience? This is,
oh, for my undergrad.
Oh, there you go. There you go. So a few people, well, one or two. I think usually this is a completely different thing. Usually, I have to explain a lot of out of the particle physics and the quantum computing, because everyone knows the astronomy. So I've pulled a couple of things from our astrophysics lectures just to explain to you what that kind of image is and why we're interested in looking at neutrinos, particularly in the sort of dense neutrino region. So it started, I think, a while ago when we started looking at explosion of massive stars. So what happens, this is what eventually leads to what we call a supernova, which are one of these great fireworks that you see in, well, I suppose we've got now quite a few pictures, and we can see signs of lots of these sort of events, particularly if you're from the neutrino community. We like those events because they will usually generates lots and lots and lots of neutrinos. So this usually works like this, where the star eventually runs out of fuel. So you have to take a reasonably big star, something that's about 8 times the mass of our sun, and it runs through all of the processes that it has, starts making lots and lots of different nuclei. When it gets to iron is essentially the stable stop point at which the star can really extract much more energy out of fusion. So the core stops, essentially, the fusion stops And because that was balancing the gravitational pressure, you cause that tube to suddenly shrink and contract. Usually, stars do that all the time. Right? So when that happens, usually it's fine because that then reignites the fusion and then it continues again. That's how we make the shells. But here, because we are iron, it just contracts and just goes, oh, I can't really do very much. While that's happening, the last part of silicon burning continues depositing iron into the core until we reach a critical mass. And at that stage, the star just decides it has enough, particularly the core, and I'm just going to collapse. So it collapses, cools down, and generates. So this is quite quick. This happens within about a second. The star starts to collapse, the core collapses, and we have processes like neutralizations, photosintegration that starts releasing all sorts of neutrinos. At one stage, imagine this big core collapsing, things get smaller and smaller and smaller. And of course, at one stage, the nuclear forces just go, well, hang on a minute. We're nice, but we're not that nice. At one stage, we're going to stop compressing this. So the nuclear force then essentially, the nuclear force is forcing the core to rebound, and essentially a shockwave that is then sent back out. Which is what is shown here on the right, that causes the rebound or called rebound shock. We would think that is then the explosion of your supernova, but what happens is this shock then encounters the rest of the matter that keeps falling into the core because gravitation keeps pulling things out. So eventually, the shock propagates outwards. I think that's what we have on this nice diagram from Yanka here. The shock sort of propagates forward, and then stuff keeps coming down, which means that essentially we have a stalled shock. So a shock front and the infalling matter end up in some sort of weird equilibrium for not very long. The core continues to become trying to become a neutron star, essentially. And then you have sort of two options. If you can put more energy into that shock, you will go supernova and you will have an explosion. If you don't, eventually you become a super bloated neutron star. This is not what our physicists really call it, but that's what I call it. And then that is what's going to become a black hole eventually, because you have also mass limits on neutron stars. So you have essentially those two options. And for a while, people were wondering, well, how do we know which of the two options are they going to be? The weird thing is we're not seeing necessarily quite as many black holes as we'd expect to see if that was really always the case. So we thought, well, most of the time, then there must be, most of the time we're talking supernovas. So it's not like we've got millions and millions of those, but most of the time, we see what we call a shock revival. And so this is where the neutrino bits become interesting. People then thought that, we still think that this occurs through what we call a delayed neutrino heating mechanism. So what is that? The idea is your neutron star has to cool down, and essentially because there's a lot of energy that from gravitation when you actually make a neutron star. So neutrino is probably the best way of getting energy out of there, and the neutrinos then interact with free neutrons and protons that are there. So we have some capture that occurs, heat up this, what we call this gain layer, quite close to the core of the star. And the thinking is that this reheated gas eventually is able to carry the shock, revive the shock, and essentially go supernova. So from an astrophysics point of view, see, by then, my astrophysicist colleagues are happy. They're like, yeah, that's fine. And then I start talking to them about neutrino. They fall asleep because they're like, well, whatever, we know how it works. I'm like, well, actually, maybe we don't really know how this works, right? This is quite a dense. So this is the thing. Usually, this is an extremely dense medium, and we can imagine having strongly interacting neutrinos. So actually trying to understand what's happening in that strong interaction region is important for, one, or trying to understand fully the heating, but there's also other aspects of the dynamics of what's happening in the explosions, where the simulated explosions, if you don't include neutrinos or heating, you have usually some issues, and it has also ultimately some implication on nucleosynthesis and what sort of elements are produced when stuff comes out of the supernova. All right, I will stop talking about astrophysics for a bit. Now, clearly I had some slides on particle physics. I'm gonna go through quite quickly because I'm hoping most of you will not necessarily need to tell you what neutrinos are, but all the same, you know, I had one of my PhD students kindly prepared some neutrino slides, and it feels like I have to show them because they're quite nice. They make, we have some nice pictorial description of neutrinos. So for people who don't know, neutrinos are elementary particles with no charge and a very small mass, a very, very small mass. And they exist in two distinct flavors. So the catch with neutrinos is that we have detected those through their interaction with particles. We have not, so we named them after the interaction they came from. So we have electron neutrinos, muon neutrinos, and tau neutrinos. But these naming of neutrinos do not coincide with their mass eigenstates, which means that in general, we can't really say, oh, an electron neutrino has that much mass. It's a mixture of mass states, which is quite complex, I suppose. It's not super complex. We think there's three. Whether M1 is smaller than M2, which is smaller than M3, or whether it's the other way around, is not completely settled, although we tend to prefer M1 smaller than M2 smaller than M3. And then the flavor state that we observe, so the thing that the interaction is happening with, is a superposition of mass eigenstates. This is essentially, I think for someone who's a quantum mechanics person, I'm just fine with this. I'm like, sure, just have a superposition of three states. And there's a unitary matrix that connects all of these. It's called the PMS matrix, and everyone's busy measuring some of the elements of that matrix. But overall, like, okay, so it's every particle is sort of a mixture of these three mass states. That's the part I don't usually show to the astrophysicists, because remember by now they are asleep. The thing that wakes them up a little bit is this, because I said, well, okay, so why don't care? Well, what actually matters is that imagine you produce a neutrino in a specific flavor. So here, for example, say we take an electron neutrino, because this is actually what happens. The astrophysicists know very well what we call the solar neutrino problem, which is you can actually calculate how many electron neutrinos are being produced by, for example, our sun. And then when that got measured, suddenly there was a bit, we didn't get quite as many as we expected. And this is because since they don't have a definite mass, it's just a superposition of three mass states. As you travel, or as they travel through space, they will oscillate. So the electron neutrino that we produce, and if you measure it later, for example, here at Earth, could be detected as a muon or a tau neutrino. And the initial case could not be detected at all, because they had, I think in the original experiments, they were only detecting electron neutrinos, and because they probably, well, they are the only ones that actually interact reasonably with matter. So that got people, usually astrophysicists, a little bit more interested in neutrinos. I'm not saying they're not interested, it's just that they have other stuff that they're particularly interested in. So, we want to simulate this, we want to understand neutrinos just a bit more. So, we can do things like oscillations. So, this is some of the early examples of what we did a little while back on using quantum computers to simulate neutrino oscillations. I will talk to you a little bit more about this, but I just wanted to show you that this is typically the sort of oscillation profile that we have. We are all in a weird neutrino units of length divided by energy, because most of your particle physicists can be all down with that. This is fine. And here, this is looking at what we call the survival probability. So this is the probability of essentially your neutrino still staying staying as it is. So if we start initially with an electron neutrino, it sort of also changes flavor and then comes back up again as an electron neutrino a little bit later on. And then we have similar profiles for muons and taus. What excited us reasonably well at the time is the dots that we see is what was simulated using one of the quantum computers that the NQCC put at our disposal, and we were like, okay, this is fine, this is roughly okay. We broadly reproduce what happens, and it seems to follow theory reasonably well. So then we thought, let's be bold. This is just a neutrino in vacuum, a single neutrino in vacuum. Maybe we can do better than this. So then we went through to adding some matter oscillate, so matter potential. So this was what we call a Wolfenstein potential, which essentially simulates how electron neutrinos interact with matter. It doesn't have interactions for the muon or the tau channel. And what we see is sort of what we'd expect. We have the top panel is the electron channel. So we're looking at a single muon neutrino that is now left to its own device and propagate there. And as we increase the strength of the matter interaction, we see that or survival probability just goes down and down and down, while the other channels, muons and tau, are getting a little bit increased. We're happy with this. I mean, this sort of works reasonably well. This was also a test of the quantum computing simulations, and they are pretty much close to what we'd expect for the analytical results. Now, clearly, this is just a single neutrino. We have analytical solutions for this. We don't need to bring quantum computer for that. So why do we do this? Well, the idea is first we wanted to test whether it actually, or where it actually works, because this is meant to be a reasonable problem to run on a quantum computer. But what we wanted to do ultimately is try and see whether if we start adding more and more neutrinos, maybe this gives us a simpler formalism to actually look at interactions at or quantum interaction at a larger scale. Remember, what we want to do is try and understand what happens when we have loads and loads of neutrinos, ideally near a star that or inside an exploding star, and trying to understand what's going on. So we started looking at interactions. So traditionally, neutrinos don't really interact very much with each other. Like sometimes when I talk to people who do photonic quantum computers, I think that's a bit like photons. You know, when you try and entangle them, it's a bit harder. But the idea is here, because we're in a dense medium inside a coarse collapse supernova, we think there's definitely a good chance that they will likely interact, because they are tightly close to each other. From a particle physics point of view, we parameterize those using some sort of forward scattering process. This is what we call refraction processes, where you have essentially things that either leave your neutrinos sort of unchanged with respect to their initial and final momenta, or you have a sort of exchange scattering where we exchange momentum from particles. And it's all reasonably well documented. I mean, this is a paper from 95 or so, but there's plenty of literature on people looking at how we can look at neutrino-neutrino interactions. In our case, we're interested both in the neutrino and anti-neutrino sectors, so we're going to park all of those together. But we still wanted to put all of that on a quantum computer because we thought, maybe a very, very large collective regime might be an interesting case study for us. So what we did is use what we call a simplified collective neutrino model. We decided, even though there are three flavors, we only use two to make things easier. To be honest, most of the interesting things happens for the electron neutrinos, because they're the ones that interact the most with matter. So we'll keep those. In particular, also, they're the ones that seem to participate more readily in all of the reactions that we've seen. And then we'll just have like electron neutrino and other. So it's the neutrino X. And we'll be like, okay, so it's a two-state model, which should make the math a little bit simpler. And then in that case, if we do it this way, we have sort of two mass channels that we call mass one and mass two, and we use what we'll call the vacuum mixing angle, which will correspond to, I think this is electron and neon mixing angle. It's an approximation, but the idea is we want to go for quite a large collection of neutrinos, and then we can always make it harder afterwards. We're also going to cheat a little bit, and we're going to ignore initially the matter interaction. We'll put it back afterwards later, but initially we thought we'll just have a standard vacuum propagation, and then what we're interested in is adding this interaction between that. So there's actually quite a convenient way of writing this using what people call flavor isospin notation. Mainly, this becomes clearer later when we look at how this maps to a quantum computer, but it enables us to look at a set of spin operators. So we'll have one term that looks after the vacuum oscillations. So we'll have a mass vector direction that looks at the mass trajectories, and then we're looking at how the isospin is parallel or perpendicular to that mass direction. And then the maybe slightly more interesting part when we talk about the interactions is essentially how two neutrinos' momentum or isospin might couple to each other. And here we have a coupling constant and a sort of cosine dependent strength, which will sort of help us tell whether your neutrinos are sort of collinear or whether they are deviating a little bit. We'll see when we when I show you the model in about a minute that the assumption is that the neutrinos will sort of radiate out, so they sort of come out with a slightly different angle. I've got them here. So if we imagine the core of our star here, and so there's what we call the neutrino sphere, which sort of starts a little bit before that, or finishes a little bit before this, we'll look at from 60 kilometers from the center to about 250 kilometers. And the idea is the neutrinos would stream out like this, and they they can, you don't have to, but they can have like a slight different solid angle between them. So we have typically two neutrinos and we'll write it like that. Now, if we look at what the Hamiltonian looks like, and we put on, I suppose, a hat of, say, condensed matter physicists for a minute, this actually looks like sort of an Einstein-type model or a Heisenberg-type model. It looks like a model where we would have a set of magnetic spins. So if I was to write magnetic Hamiltonians, it would look very much like this. The constant or the strength is slightly different, but that's roughly what it looks like, which is actually going to be quite good news for us, because the quantum computing people spend quite a lot of time solving magnetic phase transition, these kind of things. So a lot of the tools are already there. We're going to assume that the coupling strength is isotropic for us, so that we don't have too many problems. The neutrinos now are emitted, and essentially they will travel quite far and fast, and they will drift apart. So we'll simulate this by changing the coupling strength, because we're going further and further away. We're interested in having a model where we can look at essentially some gravity influence on there. We're quite close to quite a massive object that might even be from a black hole at some stage. What are the effects on some of the parameters? And clearly, there's many, many ways of doing it. So people have been doing this for a while. You have two sort of types of approximations that people are doing. There's what we call a single angle approximation, where you assume that all the neutrinos are coming out collinearly, and you're looking at sort of chunk, a beam, if you wish, of neutrinos. And then you have something that looks a bit like in electronic structure, we call it a random phase approximation to some extent, where you sort of more or less trying to write out your expectation values of your dot product as a product of two expectation values. So essentially trying to trace out a set of degrees of freedom and you have an effective potential. This is sort of a mean field theory of sort. They both work, but I think the question that we're trying to pursue is to say, well, sure, they might work, but what are we neglecting? What effects are maybe not there when we look at the mean field rather than instantaneous interactions? All right. How many are quantum computing experts? Not many.
Okay,
that's good. That's good. So I have a couple of slides to explain quantum computing. So the idea here is you could very rightly ask yourself, why on earth? Why does anybody want to do this on a quantum computer? Why don't we just have perfectly fine computers? We do. We have very good computers. I spend ages programming normal computers for probably most of my time. But the idea here is quantum computing could give us just slightly different pathways of doing things. The idea there is if we can map our system, we essentially don't have to calculate it. We just have to observe it. So it's a bit like constructing an experiment that happens to solve the problem that we're looking at. So how does that work? Instead of having normal bits that go 0 and 1, we have two bits that have state 0, state 1. And typically, people represent this on this block sphere here. So the idea would be if you want state 0, you're at the top. If you're at state 1, you're at the bottom. But because this is quantum mechanics, the coefficients that you have can be complex numbers. And that also means that you can make essentially combinations of zeros and ones. So if we want to simplify that to the extreme, it's like saying instead of being just on and off, you could be any way between on and off on a complex way. We need, like we do on a normal computer, to be able to perform operations on this quantum base. This is usually done using unitary rotations. We can rotate these, and these end up being SU2 body matrices, so we can make superpositions. There's also a whole set of operations that enable us to look at multiple qubits, so essentially how we go from a one qubit to 2, 3, 4, 5 at the minute. Some of the, we could get probably up to reasonably 200 and also on atom-based quantum computer. The ones we've been using are around 100, 120 qubits. So we have also gates that enable us to control what happens. And this lets us make non-classical states, so entangled states, things where we have essentially what we say, oh, if this qubit does this, you do that with the other one. So we can generate algorithm with those, very much the same as we can generate algorithm on a normal classical computer. Of course, it sort of, when you're doing it that way, it brings us back to a bit more like the very early days of computing, where really you end up having to, you know, you specify your circuit and it does things that way. Maybe sometimes really close to sort of how you would do it with sort of actual electronics. But despite of all these great quantum things that you can do, all these quantum operations, ultimately you still have to get the results. You still have to get some classical results out, because the normal computer that only interfaces with are classical. So you measure your qubit, and in the end, you just get 0 or 1. And the only advantage or disadvantage, I mean, the advantage is you can sort of tailor what sort of result you're going to get, because it comes with a it comes out with a probability that's proportional to the coefficients that you put in. But that's also the disadvantage, because you don't really get a definite answer. You just get a probabilistic answer to what the result is. So usually, typically, we will run these experiments many times. And this is a simple experiment that I've plucked out for you. These are real results from one of the machines, where I was, I think, trying to get it to measure sort of mixed entangled state. I'm not a particularly lucky person in general as well. So I was expecting a sort of 50-50 thing. It didn't quite work out that way. So we've got sort of, this one is 0, 1, and 1, 0. So you end up with something. We see that when we do measurements, we have some little fringes here. But, you know, by and large, you could sort of work out that, okay, it's doing things, it's got qubits, you can make things, and it sort of does what you want. Great. So I was like, oh, this is good. Let's map. So we only have two states. That works quite well. So we can map our flavors. We could say, okay, electron neutrino is going to be zero, state zero. Other neutrino will be state one. The isospins operator also lie on this SU2 type algebra. So I was like, oh, this is like a poly matrix. So we can use poly matrices now to act as our isospin operators. And because we have an isotropic interaction, this is actually what we call an XXX Heisenberg model, where everything is isotropic in all directions. So we can essentially rewrite or equation in terms of a poly matrix here and some X matrices here. There's a couple of X, Y, and Z poly matrices. So that this part implements the Heisenberg model, and this is doing the vacuum. So a couple of factors that creep up just because of the way these particular Pauli matrices are implemented on the quantum computer. But basically, all we need to do then, we set up the flavors that we want. We say, quantum computer, here's the Hamiltonian. Please do the thing, propagate. And so we can evolve then the state from sort of the end of the neutrino sphere inside the game layer and past the shock region. So in practical terms, and this is my last slide on quantum computing, so here's the theory. This is essentially what we do. We have states, we apply Hamiltonian. We have to essentially discretize this to make it computable, because most of those, there's permutation relations, etc. So we end up having to make sort of small steps. So we ended up sort of splitting things into half steps. It turned out that instead of using time, it was probably easier to use radial steps, but that's sort of the same thing. I think the interesting thing is we end up with essentially a circuit, which is how we programmed it onto the computer, that is reasonably simple in the sense that we have flavor to mass at the start, transformation, a mass to flavor transformation at the end, and then in the middle, we will just do half vacuum, or interaction half vacuum, and that yellowish bit is what moves the wave function forward. So we do, if you're on the first time set, you just do it once. If you're on the second time set, you do it twice, and then et cetera. So you sort of repeat this as many times as you want, and by the end, you have repeated it 40 times, 50 times, however many times you want, and you start then from the end, and it just carries you all the way to the end. Our aim was to do 100 neutrinos or qubits model. I'll put that out there because now I'm going to show you some results. We'll be able to reflect on whether that is a realistic goal in this particular study. So, well, okay, let's be exciting. Let's start to test things. So we started putting no interactions into things. This is a vacuum propagation. It should be the same sort of code that we had before. I'm starting with just two neutrinos, a neutrino and an antineutrino. So I've got two sectors here, neutrino sector and neutrino sector. And we're just looking at oscillations and how they are reproduced compared to the analytical. This looks really good because this is a simulation of the quantum computer. So very, very long time ago when I started doing this, people said, oh, always start with a simulation because you need a simulation. And they said, you need a simulation. So we need a simulation, so this works quite well. Then we're like, okay, does it work when we add some interactions? When we started putting interactions, we see things are starting to get a little bit dampened, and it's we see a little bit of structure there, but it seems to work. It's okay. We use adaptive steps because the idea is we have stronger oscillations at the start that we have at the end, so we don't need maybe as many time steps towards the end. Well, this is working well. We then also started looking at simulating. So the 3+3 system. So here we have a set of three different energies for initial neutrinos. And what we start seeing, I wanted to compare this with the single angle approximation to the mean field approximation. The mean field sort of split things. So low energy neutrinos keep their flavor. High energy neutrinos tend to lose their flavors. So we have a sort of phase separation even, and we see that the quantum part sort of follows it roughly, and that seems to happen on both sectors. Seems to be dampened quite a bit, but if we actually move to a multiple angle model, so which is close to what we simulated in our model, we have a little bit less splitting, and roughly, you know, if you squint, you go, yeah, okay, it sort of works. Sort of, it's reasonable. emboldened by this, we thought, we'll now go on the real machine and see hope whether we can actually reproduce the squiggles, whatever the squiggles are. Well, okay. So this real machine, you start having to pay some real money now. So it's not my money, it's the NQCC's money, but all the same, you know, we mind. So I'm going to do only 20 times, 20 steps, because I know roughly what's happening. So I'm going to undersample some of the oscillations. So sometimes when it does things like that, it means we know that underneath there's probably quite a few oscillations underneath. But I wanted to see roughly, I'm interested to see whether I see that phase separation. Not going to have a phase separation with a 1+1 system, but this was the simulation at the top, right? This is the real machine at the bottom, and I was, oh my goodness me, this is really good. This is close. This is really, really close. Oh, so good. I felt really happy. Then I added more neutrinos, so I have my simulation at the top, and then I'm like, oh, what is happening here? This is the real calculation, so I started to be a bit too, okay, not quite what I expected, but maybe it's just 2+2. Who knows? Chucked a few more things in there. Simulation, fantastic. Real machine, blah. Yeah, I mean, you know, if I'm being, you know, super optimistic, I mean, well, it sort of follows some of the curve. Not the right ones, but it sort of follows some of the curves. So, what sort of is going on? See, this was my thinking while I was taking the bus to come here, depending on which side is that. The simulation worked really well. It was really good. It looked super promising. And I've run it on a real machine. And it's a little bit bleaker than we thought. I mean, we know this to some extent, right? It's like whenever you do something experimentally, you have some measurement errors, et cetera, et cetera. I think here there's a couple of things that happen. The simulation are not really taking much of the actual real machine. So simulations are a bit too ideal, if you wish.
Yep. You're using this QScape for simulation?
Yes.
There you are also loading the there's something called machine dynamics, something like that.
Yeah, so you can load, you could take into account the parameters from the machine, et cetera, to try and make the simulation even more realistic.
Yeah.
But ultimately, the way this works is when I make all these many, many steps, I probably hit what we call some of the issues with essentially the survival of these qubits. So they sort of decohere, and by the time, in fact, most of the curve ended up roughly around halfway, which is what you'd expect if you've got things that were a little bit wrong. But, you know, I'm not panicking quite yet, because the two-level model actually fits quite well for quantum computer. In simulations, they both show some of this onset of phase transition, like this splitting that we may be looking for, just because it's interesting and it's more than a mark of sort of this sort of condensed system. Running on real hardware actually is really what we need in order to be able to develop better versions of this. So now the plan is, we know how to fix this, but we're only about 1 month into this project, so there's a bit of time left. I have a very good idea of how to fix this, but I wanted to first you start simple. You go, okay, how well, you know, will this work? And it's interesting that even though hardware has come on quite a bit, you can't just, you have to still be quite careful into how you program these computers. And I think I'm sort of hopefully just on time, and I'll finish with this. Also, huge thank you to NQCC that have been very patient with us and gave us lots of computing time. and or HPC whole as well. And this, I think the fifth question is.
Thank you. I think I have about 100 questions.
Okay.
I let everybody run fast first, so please.
Can I go back to the beginning? It's probably implicit in everything you're talking about, but you didn't mention the value exclusion principle, and that's what's stopping the star.
That's
collapsing.
Right. Yeah.
Does it back pressure on the neutrinos?
I think so. What happens is it initially stops the collapse, but then you get to a point where they get sort of reabsorbed into, so this is this neutronization phase where the electrons that usually will keep the core from collapses get reabsorbed into the nuclei, and they essentially lose a lot of the electrons, and then it continues again.
But I was worried about the neutrino emission being held up because the warring states.
Oh, okay, yeah. So what happens is when you have quite a lot of electrons and matter, so yes, it does block some of the neutrino emission because it's sort of quite opaque in the initial stages. But by the time you reach the sort of end phase, which is where you're making your neutron star, this becomes much less opaque to neutrinos. So you suddenly have streams. I think these are the sort of neutrino streams that we can see sort of from outside. They come more from what we call the late stage proton neutron star type stage in the early stages. You are right, like the early stages when you have all these neutrino emission, they are a bit trapped initially in the middle layers, that's called.
Isn't it the case though? I mean, you've got inverse beta decay happening.
Yes. Yeah.
And what's happening is you're releasing neutrinos,
yes,
during the proton-neutron phase. And what happens is you've got some multiple scattering of those neutrinos.
That's right.
So they're not actually coming out parallel.
Exactly.
They're random. So if you look at the surface of the, say, neutrinosphere surface, they're coming out to all angles.
Exactly. Yeah.
So your initial graph would show the two neutrinos coming out, say, diverging,
yeah,
is not actually correct.
Well, it's I think what you can do is you can then play with obviously the angle that they're coming out at, which is what, you know, probably when we do these multi-angle, we will pick those at random. I mean, you're entirely right. There's no real reason where we get like streams like
that. Right.
They will be scattered and they come at different angles.
Yes.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I think here was more, I thought I'd make a picture that sort of shows the parameters rather than necessarily being.
So just another question. Were you actually considering the region between the proton neutron star surface or the neutrino surface and the shock, and you're considering that just vacuum?
Well,
it matter oscillation is going on there as well.
That's actually quite important. So the matter interaction is quite important. In fact, we can often show in this other simulations I've shown that if you actually include matter interaction, you could sometimes even quench the entire thing entirely. We removed it initially because we wanted to see whether if we assume it's vacuum, which clearly isn't, do we, you know, what is the physics that we're seeing there? And then the plan is to then add matter interactions back to try to see, well, okay, does that affect the dynamics that we're seeing? Mm-hmm. But yeah, definitely. I mean, at the minute, this is not a realistic supernova simulation because it's missing, the matter is missing. It's not enough neutrinos to really be even competing with some of the mean field theories. But the idea was to try and construct this from the ground up and then add the effects one after the other to see, okay, this does this, this part does that, et cetera, et cetera.
So would the end game your simulations actually explain the explosion? Because we don't know how the star explodes.
Yes, exactly. So I think the end game, if we could explain the explosions, fantastic. I think we'll have to be probably a little bit more modest here and say, well, the end game would be to already see if you have many quantum neutrinos, you know, neutrinos with a quantum description, and we'll try and see how big can we go to see, can we maybe validate some of the mean field models and then say, okay, they all seem to be all right, and then you could use the mean field models to describe the properties reasonably accurately.
Mm-hmm.
Or are we seeing some sort of really correlated effects that you're sort of missing out from mean field? Because you could do multiple angle mean field models, that people do that. This is fine. I think the question is, coming from something that is maybe more like, I know, for example, in electronic structure theory, this is not correct, that the mean field model misses out lots of correlated things, and we usually have to add it back. So the idea was to say, well, if we take this to neutrinos, to neutrino physics, do we see the same, you know, how much are we missing by using a mean field compared to an explicit calculation? I think that was the motivation behind it. And it may be that then would explain some of the weirdnesses that we have, but it's still part of the physics that we need to add before we can say this is a proper supernova type model. I agree.
Sorry, I probably just didn't follow, but I didn't understand what advantage you were getting from the quantum community. You seem to be validating it all against classical.
Yeah, so there's only so much that you can do. There's only so much that you can do without the quantum computer. So you can simulate this classically up to about 30 qubits, so 30 particles in total. When you get to 35, 36, you need supercomputers. By the time you get to 40, basically, I would probably have to use the whole of Dirac, and I probably wouldn't even get there. So you hit a limit on sort of your explicit calculations. So the only alternative that you have is then you have to do mean field. So our hope is that once you get on a quantum computer, the quantum computer will happily give you 100 qubits and give you the result for that. The classic, you know, you will have to measure it, so you get the result, but you can, within the quantum computer, run the quantum, you know, have no mean field at all. You can have the sort of exact input result. And I think what we're up against at the minute is making sure we can do all the operations that we need to do without the qubits sort of decohering, because we take too long to actually tell it what to do. I mean, that's it.
Well, at this point, aren't you proving that that doesn't work?
Well, I think I'm going to assume that I'm doing it wrong initially. I'm going to go, it's not working just because the coherence time that we have on the machine at the minute is still quite short. And there might be some other machines that are better at this. And it may just be that there's a more clever way of doing it. So we're already working on things where, for example, not all the interactions are important, so we could try and prune some of this stuff down. There's different ways in which we could reformulate the propagation, for example. So there's quite a few tricks that we can still, you know, we're not out of tricks yet. But it's a very, so the idea is, can we actually do it at all? You're right. It may be that we get to there and go, actually, this is too complex a problem for the hardware that we have at the minute. But I think, yeah, if you don't try, I'll show you. Yeah, we'll never know otherwise.
Yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
So I first wanted to ask, like, how much energy is actually transferred by the neutrinos interacting with the supercomputer?
So we think that when in sort of the later stage in so when you're creating the protoneutron star, so the final star, that is actually quite a lot of energy that is that you get from essentially gravitational collapse. And most of that energy, in the estimation of about at least 90%, comes off as is going into neutrinos. How much is then taken back is probably unclear. I think the idea is you can calculate sort of heating rates and things like that, but essentially all you need is to have enough energy to sort of tip the shock over to then get it to explode. So it's not that you need necessarily a lot, astrophysical units, right? A lot is probably quite a lot, but you still, you don't need to have 10 to the 46 joules just dumped in there for it to happen. Your shock is coming out, your infalling matter is coming in. So you're sort of essentially, you just need to disrupt the equilibrium enough that then it just goes, okay, it sort of essentially bubbles out. But there's loads of things hidden behind that I haven't talked about. For example, we know that these explosions are not symmetrical at all. They end up being really stretched. All the simulations give you and even the observations give you very weird remnants from this. And so there's some preferential channel. It could be that you just, a bit like a bubble, you just burst one part and then that's maybe what's causing it. We don't know. It could be that it's just to do with the structure inside it, etc. That would also
So it's it's good enough as long as it can just pass through some kind of threshold.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. It's not, so what we're saying is it's not the neutrinos that are completely driving the explosion itself. There's already some things happening, but the neutrinos might be there to help break the deadlock that you have. Because, energy transfer through neutrinos, it's dense matter, but it's not also super efficient. Right. Otherwise, we wouldn't need a big detector and go, oh, yeah, look, super cross section, we'll get those in neutrinos.
I actually had one
more. You go ahead.
I actually had another question about the quantum computing part.
Yeah.
So it's more of a confusion because when I learned about quantum computing, it was usually at the middle state, it's fine to go superposition, but at the final state, you have to project it to one or zero. But it seems it's doing something completely opposite of that.
No. I think here, you still have to measure. You still have to say at the end, you're measuring your qubits and you'll get just zero or one. The whole thing is what you do in quantum computing is you're trying to sort of engineer the superpositions or the entanglements so that they enable you to compute what you want. It's the tricky part, I think, is that a lot of people using quantum computers are trying to simulate or to do normal computing with it. So they're like, oh, they're representing numbers. But actually, the easiest thing for quantum computers to do is just to do some quantum physics, because that's actually what it does. So in all cases, we're making something more like an analog, I suppose, of your neutrinos, and you say, well, yeah, so we don't need for it to carry. We're just basically, it's a bit as if we had a detector there, and we say, well, is it an electron neutrino or other neutrino? And then we just measure them. And all we need to do is just engineer sort of the dynamics essentially inside the quantum computer. I want it to be, headline catching, I would say, a supernova inside a quantum computer. That's really modern. Yeah, it worked for the tabloids, I suppose.
I got the impression that it was for like a miniature hardware Monte Carlo device.
Yeah, well, at the minute, that's probably what it looks like, but hopefully we can make it a bit more purposeful.
Okay, Bob?
Yeah, a couple of points. In the quantum calculations you're doing, you're representing neutrinos with qubits.
Yes.
But you were always, they were in phase, so you But you did mention that there's a randomness to it.
Yes.
There's a random phase approximation that you didn't, you alluded to it, but you didn't actually discuss.
Yes.
So is that where the problem arises in not being able to, say, get the right result?
Yeah, so when you do it, so in the classical approximations, well, it's not, I'm calling it classical as in the not quantum computer versions, you will typically use RPA, so you use a random phase approximation, or similarly, sort of mean field type approximation,
yeah,
where you're going to say, okay, that neutrino sees all the others, they're wave, you know, you essentially have a separable wave function. The key here is we don't need to have a separable wave function, so we could generate a state that is 40 neutrinos all entangled together, not a separable state that that you can't factor out basically, and then we can propagate that state and see what the end result is. That's, I think, the difference between doing it that way or doing it using RPA or some of the other methods is at some stage you're sort of factoring out part of your system so that you can treat it.
Yeah, that makes. One more point. I mean, in the neutrino problem, I mean, it's recognized that about 1% of the neutrino energy coming from the core has got to be dumped around about the shockwave. So that's the main problem. How does that neutrino energy communicate with the matter behind the shock to revive the shock?
Yeah.
So you've got to raise the temperature by about, say, well, up to about half an MeV in the material behind the shock.
Exactly.
So that's the big problem.
And you also have only pretty much one channel that really interacts, which would be your electron neutrino. So if you sort of, if your oscillations are sort of dampen that much that all your electron neutrinos now become other neutrinos, you can't do it. And I think that's the point I would try. What's interesting here is we're seeing the ones that would have the high energy, they basically just and you're okay. So then it's not them, but how much energy is then left in the sort of low energy neutrino structure to actually do that, that becomes sort of the emission profile. So I think that's what we're trying to drive at first, to try and see, is it then going to be really a bipolar split, or do we have like a distribution, and is some of that removed from this by your sort of mean field approximation?
Any questions from Zoom? Please unmute if you have anything. Looks like not. Anything else on room? I would hold my questions for later for the lunch. Please do feel free to join us for lunch and we'll be happy to interact with you. So let's thank our speaker. Thank you. Thank you.
Or thought.